Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Krisus Daf Vov. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage. If you are already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the Daf before the Shiur, and even better, order your personal volume of this Maseches. Our address is gmarkings@gmail.com. At the end of our previous Shiur, we were dealing with Simona Milsa, different practices that can serve as a good omen or a good sign for future events. Continuing in this, in that spirit, we have a comment made by Rav Mesharshia, which we feature as an introduction to this piece of Gemara in our Nosei heading, which you find in the outside margin under what we label the Nosei, the topic. In the Shas Ozer, the Shas that appears on your screen, the Gemara that is the cornerstone of Gemara markings, we offer title headings and structural notes that we call Mivneh from time to time. In this case, we wrote on the outside margin, Divrei Rav Mesharshia Levonov, the words of Rav Mesharshia to his sons, Lahatzliach Belimud, for success in their Torah study, the Od Eitzos, and other words of advice. So we now continue with the Gemara, five lines from the top at the end of the line, Omar Le Rav Mesharshia Levonei. Rav Mesharshia says to his sons, Ki bo'isu lemezal lemigmar kami rabchon, when you want to go to study, to learn in the presence of your teacher, groisu meikora masnisen, first study the relevant Mishnayos, v'hadar olu kami rabchon, and then go to listen to your teacher who will expound on that. The idea of preparing for the shir is the central point of this recommendation. V'chi yasvisu kame rabchon, and when you are sitting in his presence, chazi lepume de rabchon, literally you should be able to see his mouth, in other words, see his face as he is lecturing. Shenemar v'hoyu einecha ro'os es morecha. The Pasuk says that your eyes should behold your master. In other words, you should see the one who is teaching. V'chi grisisu shmaitza, and when you review your learning, your teachings, grosu algabi naro demaya, learn and study by a flowing river, a river of water. V'chi hechi demashchi maya timshoch shmaitzchon. Just as the river is continually flowing, so too your learning will be continually flowing. In other words, an expression of expertise and fluency in your studies. Further pieces of advice, Akilkali demasa mechasya velo apadni de pobedisa. Better to be by the garbage heaps of mechasya than by the mansions of pobedisa. Rashi explains that Pobedisa was known as a place where there were many thieves. So his advice here is to stay away and not be allured by the tinsel and glitter of places that are of questionable repute. Tav gildena sarya lemechal mikuscha darami kifi. Better is to eat the fish as it, gildenar is a fish, a small fish, as it nears its, as it nears rotting. In other words, not rotten fish, but as it's coming close to that. Rashi quotes the Gemara in Moed Katan that says that a fish, just before it goes bad, is actually very beneficial. So better to eat that than kuscha. Now kuscha is a good type of food, but this fish is even better. Kuscha, which is it's a dairy type food, which is in this case is described as a very strong. It's described elsewhere as a type of food that is as a dairy food, as we said, and here it's very strong and intense and capable of figuratively of smashing rocks. That's the rummy kifi or rocks. So it's a very strong kuscha, but his advice is better to eat this gilden asarya than even this potent kuscha. The pasuk says regarding Chana, the mother of the famous prophet Shmuel, it says Vatispalel Chana Vatomar Vatomar Olatzlibi Bashem Romo Karni. The word karni is the focus of this piece of Gemara. Karni is literally a horn. A horn was used as a receptacle to hold, in this case, to hold oil. The horn is going to be featured here in contrast to a type of jug that would hold oil. And Chana was a prophetess. And it's pointed out she was praying that her horn should rise, Roma Karni. The horn, which held oil was used for anointing kings. Roma Karni velo Roma Parchi. My horn should rise and not my jug. David uShlomo sheNimshechu beKeren Nimshlo Malchusam. David and Shlomo, who were anointed through the oil held in a horn, their monarchy lasted. The Davidic dynasty lasted throughout the entire first Beis Hamikdash period, and the concept of leadership actually is something that continues through the descendants of David HaMelech. Shaul v'Yehu shenimshlu min hapach. Shaul HaMelech and Yehu, who was a king of the Malchus Yisrael later on, they were anointed through oil held in a pach, in a jug, lo nimshlu malchusam, but their dynasties did not last. Hamefatim es haktoras. The Mishnah had mentioned that one will be guilty of kores if he prepares the incense that was used in the Beis Hamikdash. Obviously, he's not preparing it for the Beis Hamikdash, but we'll see what the parameters are as we go on in the Gemara. Before we go on in the Gemara, let's glance at the outside margin where we have our topic headings. We have a general topic heading that we entitle Nosei Kloli, and we've indicated that it goes Ad Omid Beis. In other words, this is a very long topic in so far that it lasts till Omid Beis, and in Maseches Krisus, I'm sure you have noticed there are very large dapim of Gemara. The immediate topic, Nosei Haim Shayech Mi'ilah B'Ktoras, is the Mi'ilah violation possible when it comes to the incense? Mi'ilah is a sin that is associated with one who benefits from sanctified items. So is that Mi'ilah sin possible to violate when you're dealing with the Ktoras? The Ktoras, of course, was something that was sanctified and dedicated to the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara, Tanu Rabbanan, we open up here with a Tanaic source. As you can see, it appears in a frame. Hamafatim es haKtores. This is a reference to one who prepares the Ktoras with the Torah prescribed ingredients. So, Lelamed Bo, Oy Lemoisro Letzibra Potter. If his purpose of preparing it is for educational purposes or for dedicating it to the public, in other words, giving it over to the Beis HaMikdash, Potter, then there one is exempt. There's no guilt in that's not what the Torah prohibits. However, Lehoriach Bo Chayav, if he prepares the formal Ketores with the purpose of his own benefiting from its aroma, that would be forbidden. V'hameriach Bo Potter Elo Shemoal, one who will smell the Ketores of the Tzibor, the public Ketores, the Beis HaMikdash Ktoras, is not guilty of a kores violation. However, Ela Shemua, but he is in violation of Mi'ilah, the deriving of personal benefit from that which has been sanctified. As we go on in the next number of lines, take note of the trapezoid form, the form we fondly refer to as the volcano shape. It will be appearing in a opposite direction, in a flip-flop fashion, we'll call it. As we go on in the Gemara, you see the Mivneh heading on the outside margin. The feature, this form is featured, and we've included in parentheses the term ma'akav. Ma'akav means that this form will be used as a means of keeping track of the give and take nature of this Gemara. So with the narrow form facing upwards, those are kushios. The narrow form, when it's flipped over, represents tshuvos, responses. Now, our nosei here, we've indicated hemshech. We're not embarking on a new topic, but this is an introduction to our continuing in the topic we started. Dovar hanshinaseis mitzvaso ein bo mi'ila. We will shortly get to this issue, and we'll come back to this note when it's appropriate. Let's now start the Gemara with the volcano shape. Humi iko mi'ila bereach. Is it possible to say that there is a me'ilah violation when it comes to fragrance? V'omer Rav Shimon ben Pazi, omer Rav Yeshua ben Levi, mishum bar kapora. The following was said in the name of bar kapora: kol umara v'reach ein bohen mishum me'ilah. Kol is a sound, mara is a sight, a view of something, or reach, aroma, there is no me'ilah. In other words, even though if the source of whatever benefit here is something that is of a holy nature, if one benefits or enjoys it, he's not in violation of Mila. In other words, there was an orchestra in the Beis HaMikdash as part of the sacrificial process. Music was an accompaniment. Now, let's say someone was listening to that music and enjoyed it, so he's not in violation of Mila. Likewise, if he gazes upon the beauty of the Beis HaMikdash, and he enjoys it, and it appeals to him, he's not in violation of Mila. And what we've dashed underlined in our Gemara is Reach, which is our topic, fragrance cannot be a generator of Mi'ila. The Gemara answers, Reach, achar shetale timrosoi ein boi mishu Mi'ila. The Reach spoken about here as not generating the Mi'ila violation is the fragrance experienced after the incense has been placed on the fire of the altar, so that once the incense has been offered, then after the fact, if one benefits from the fragrance, and one enjoys that fragrance, he's not in violation of Mi'ila. And why is that? Sharei, and we've dashed underlined the theme of the next number of lines of Gemara, Sharei ein l'cho dover acher shenase mitzvasu molen bo. There is nothing that once the mitzvah for which it was designed has been performed, that would then, after the fact, would then generate Mi'ila. Once again, Mi'ila cannot be violated if you're dealing with benefit from something concerning which the mitzvah has already been performed. So, in the case of the incense, the mitzvah of the incense is to put it on the fire of the altar, of the golden mizbeach that sat in the heichal. Well, once that was done, so that's the performance of the mitzvah. You're finished. Now that there still is fragrance that can be enjoyed, that will not generate a me'ila violation. So what was mentioned before concerning the me'ila possibility by the fragrance, by the ktores, that was prior to its being offered on the altar. Now the Gemara gets into the topic that we had seen just briefly under the Nosei heading. Across from here in the margin, you notice the Nosei Hemshech. We continue reading our note, which says, Dover Shenaseis Mitzvaso Ein Bo Mi'ila. An item concerning which its mitzvah has been performed will not generate a Mi'ila violation. V'ha di'esh dugmos she'esh ben Mi'ila, that we will see actually examples of things concerning which the mitzvah has been performed, and there still is a Mi'ila possibility. Ein lemeidim mehem. We are not to learn from them. They will not serve as a precedent setter. Mishum dehavu shnei ksuvim aboyim ke'echad. Because the examples we will see are actually exceptions to the rule, and there is a principle that when you have in the Torah two ksuvim, two psukim that come to teach me the same idea. In other words, two separate items that come to teach the same principle, we say that it's only in those two cases that the principle applies and nowhere else. In other words, a type of irony or we'll call it overkill, if you will, that if a if you have an example of one item that had that reflects some type of principle, we can say, well, that example is a sets a precedent for many other cases. However, if the Torah doesn't say it just once, but it says it twice, what the Torah is trying to say is it's that only in these two cases does this principle apply and not anywhere else. So that with regard to this concept of Dover Shinaseis Mitzvaso Ein Bo Me'ila, in the event that you see cases where there are, since there are two cases like that, we say that only in two cases will there be a situation of the mitzvah having already been performed and that there still is mi'ilah. But everywhere else, no. So now let's continue with the Gemara. The Gemara, after having said as a rule, Ein l'chodover, the Gemara asks, "Aloma lo? Why not?" This is a reference to the ash that's taken, a handful of ash taken off the top of the mizbech every morning, taken off the top of the altar every morning. This is ash from sacrifices that have already been burnt, so that the mitzvah has already been performed. Yet the Torah says that you take a handful of that ash and you are to place it by the side of the ramp leading up to the Mizbech. And this is done every morning. So that's, and that handful is called Trumas Hadeshen. And the Naaseis Mitzvah, so the mitzvah has already been performed. And we said the sacrifices have already been offered. U'moalin bo, but the personal benefit from that ash would lead to Me'ilah. So that here you have an example of an item of substance concerning which the mitzvah has already been done, and yet there still is a me'ilah possibility. The Gemara answers, Mishum dahavi trumas hadeshin ubigdei kahuna shnei ksuvim haboyim ke'echad. The reason for trumas hadeshin being that way is that it, along with one other case, the bigdei kahuna, the clothing of the Kohen Gadol that he used on Yom Kippur, also have this characteristic of, even though they have been used already for their mitzvah, for the Yom Kippur service, there still is a me'ilah possibility if one derives personal benefit from them. So they represent two examples, or shnei ksuvim, two verses, two psukim, haboim kechad, that come to teach the same principle. Namely, that items that the mitzvah has already been performed, and there still is a me'ilah prohibition. The chol shnei ksuvim haboim ke'echad ein melamdin. And when you have two verses coming to tell me the same principle, we don't learn from them to other cases. So we rely with regard to the Torah that has already been burnt, there is no me'ilah because the mitzvah has already been performed. And once mitzvahs have already been performed, you don't have any me'ilah violation. And if you try to cite Truma Sedeshin and Bigdei Kahuna as some type of counterexample, we say, no, they are the exception. And how do I know that they are the exception? Because they are taught that rule is of the rule of their... Me'ilah still being a possibility is taught on two occasions. The Gemara continues with a question. Ha'nicha l'rabbonan. This approach describing the Bigdei Kahuna as being subject to a continued me'ilah possibility after Yom Kippur works out only according to the Rabbonan. Ela l'Rabbi Dosa ma'iko l'meimar. But according to the Tana, Rabbi Dosa, what are you going to say? Because according to Rabbi Dosa, which we will see very shortly, he says that once the Bigdei Kahuna of the Kohen Gadol were used on Yom Kippur, there isn't a mitzvah of burying them, indicating that there is a prohibition on further use of them. And if that be the case, and according to Rabbi Dosa, Bigdei Kahuna are not an example of something Shinaseis Mitzvaso, and there will still be Me'ilah. and that would leave Trumas Hadeshin alone. And if Trumas Hadeshin is alone in that area, then it would be able to serve as a precedent. And if that be the case, I would then say that something, even though the mitzvah has already been done, there still is a me'ila possibility, and then that would create a problem for what we said earlier regarding the Reach of the Ketores as not carrying with it me'ila, because the mitzvah has already been done. So here we have a source in which you see these two opinions regarding the Big Day Kahuna, Desanya, Vihi Nicham Sham, regarding the clothing of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. The Pasuk says, and he shall place them there, Melamed Shetunim Geniza. The first opinion says that that teaches me that they must be buried. And when we say something needs to be buried, means to be put away, that it means that further benefit from them would be a violation, in this case a me'ila violation. Rabbi Dosa Omer, Ksherin Hein L'Kohen Hedyot. They don't have to be buried. The Big Day Kohen Gadol can be in continuous use. A common Kohen could use them. What is the Torah saying when it says you shall put them away? All that means is that they shall not be reused for a second Yom Kippur. But there is no teaching here that they must be buried. So as far as Rabbi Dosa is concerned, the Big Day Kahuna do not reflect an example of something concerning which the mitzvah has been done, and that there would be a continued mi'ilah, a violation. So if that's the case, as we said, that brings back into question the idea of Dover Shanaseis Mitzvaso and resurrecting the possibility that there is Me'ila, because we only have one example, and that is the Trumas Hadeshen. The Gemara answers, Mishum Davi Trumas Hadeshen Ve'egla Rufo Shnei Ksuvim Ha'boim Ke'achod. No fear, Trumas Hadeshen is really not alone. Not only Trumas Hadeshen, but Eglo Arufa also is something that once the mitzvah is done, there is a prohibition of benefiting from it. Just a word about Eglo Arufa, that's a situation that represents a situation where a murder victim was found between two cities. The two cities measure their distance from the corpse to their town. The closer city is expected to bring a calf to an uncultivated area of land, and its neck is broken, and a statement is made by the elders indicating that they are not, their declaration of non-guilt, and they are seeking atonement for the murder that took place. That's Eglo Arufa. Now, we mentioned that the Eglo Arufa, its neck, this calf's neck is broken in this uncultivated area outside of the city. One is forbidden to benefit from it, even though the mitzvah has already been done. So we have two ksuvim, we have two psukim that come together that teach me the same idea, and therefore they are the exception and they do not teach me to other things. Here the Gemara continues, Trumas Hadeshen Maihi, what's the pasuk by Trumas Hadeshen indicating that there still is a mi'ila violation, a prohibition of benefiting from it after the mitzvah was done? The Sanya, the pasuk says, V'somoy Eitzel HaMizbeach. It shall be placed, this handful of ash shall be placed next to the altar. Melamech Te'unin Geniza. This shows me that it must be buried. In other words, it's put away. It was the Trumas Hadeshen was actually miraculously absorbed into the ground, which is its burial. And as we said, burial represents the idea that that item would be forbidden to benefit from, and hence it needs to be buried. Eglo Arufa Maihi, what is the source regarding the Eglo Arufa? The Sanya, V'orfu Sham Eso Eglo Banachal. The neck of the Egel is broken over there in that area that we mentioned before, this uncultivated area. And the Pasuk says, Shom, there's a Girsa that's found right under the Gemara text and says it should read as follows. Shom, the word Shom in the Pasuk is telling me Shom Tehei Kvurasa. There shall be its burial. In other words, after the neck of the eglah is broken, it is buried over there, indicating that it would be forbidden to benefit from it. The Gemara continues with a question. Ulamadomer shnei ksuvim haboyim keechod melamdin. According to an opinion of Tanoim that says that even if you have two psukim teaching me the same principle, they can in fact serve as a precedent setter. So what am I going to say about the Torahs that was already offered on the fire? Haha, nevertheless, vadai ein melamdin. Here, with regard to the issue of nases mitzvosa, something concerning which the mitzvah has already been done, here, in this topic, these cases of eglo arufa and truma sadeshen will not be precedent setters. Mishum davi trei miuti. There are two limitation expressions in these topics, and the Gemara spells them out. B'truma sadeshen ksiv v'samoi. You shall place it. Hodein in midiachrino lo, it and not something else. In other words, the Truma Sadeshin is to be buried, and that expectation is not true with regard to other matters. Gabi eglo arufa ksiv ho arufa. Arufa in the hey of that word ho arufa is a limitation letter indicating the arufa, yes, it must be buried midiachrino lo, but not something else. So the emphasis here is on these two examples of Truma Sadeshin, eglo arufa being regarding them, there is this burial expectation, but not regarding other things. And therefore, the Ktores, after it has been burnt on the altar, there is no Mi'ilah. And that explains the statement we saw above in the name of Bar Kapora, where we had dashed under on Reach Ein Bo Mishu Mi'ilah. The source that generated this sugya, where it said that there is mi'ilah, that would be in the case of benefiting from the k'toras before the mitzvah was done. Before continuing in the Gemara, we have a topic heading, the nosei, under which we've written hamarkivim shel hak'toras. The markivim are the ingredients that make up the k'toras. For many of you, this following source may have a familiar ring to it, and that is because it's part of the davening, part of the prayer service that is accompanies the passage known as Ein Kelokeinu that is generally recited at the end of the davening. Tanu Rabbanan, Pitum Haktores, the making of the Ktores, Hatsori, Vahatsiporen. Now, as we go along, we're going to words that we don't attempt to translate are different types of plants that make up the Ktores, and in Gemara markings, we forward all people who are interested in translations to look into some of the reputable translations that exist today in the realm of Gemara study. But we don't take a chance on translating items that we don't have a continuous tradition regarding what they are. So we just refer to them by name. And so they include Hatsori, Vatsiporen, Hachelbino, Vahalavoino. Mishkal shel shivim shivim mona. The weight of these items must be 70 mona. Mona is the type of weight, of a measure of weight. Mor uktsia shiboles nerd v'charkoim. These ingredients, mishkal shisha osor shel shisha osor mona. 16 mona of each one. Hakosht shneimosor. The kosht is an ingredient that for which you bring 12 mona. Kilufa shloisha. 3 mona of kilufa. V'kinmon tisha. And 9 mona of kinmon. Boris Karshina, Tisha Kabin. 9 Kav of Boris Karshina. Later, we will see in the Gemara that the Boris Karshina was not an ingredient making up the incense, but it was a substance that was needed for treating the ingredients here in the Ketores. Yain kafrisin sin tlosa, kabin tlosa. Yain kafrisin also was not an ingredient of the incense, but it's a yain kafrisin was used to assist in the preparation, and the amount of that is 3 sa'ah and 3 kav. Im ein lo yain kafrisim, if he doesn't have that, if they don't have that ingredient or that substance, maybe chamar chivarian atik. So they'll bring chamar is old, chivarian is white. Hamar is wine, so it would be Atik is old, so it would translate here as old white wine, aged white wine. Melach stomis rova, a quarter of a kav of stomis salt. Male oshan kolshehu, male oshan is a type of grass that the translation of this male oshan is oshan is smoke, male is something causes something to rise, so it's a type of grass that would enable the smoke from the burning incense to rise in a pillar like form. Rabbi Nosson Omer af kipas hayarden kol shehu, Rabbi Nosson suggests or he mentions that kipas hayarden was also an ingredient necessary. V'im Nosson bo dvash psalah, if a person added dvash, is honey, that would ruin the ktores. The pasuk says, "Ki kol sor v'chol dvash lo saktiru." These ingredients, sor is sourdough, and dvash are forbidden to be placed on the mizbeach. If I'm not mistaken, the term dvash is actually not limited to honey per se, but it might in fact include other fruits as well. But for sure, honey. These are forbidden to be placed on the altar, and hence the statement here is that if dvash were added, even though it might be a substance beneficial for a fragrance-creating incense, nevertheless, it's forbidden to be added. Chisar achas mikol samonehel. If one of the ingredients are missing, chayav misa, that would generate a penalty, a punishment of death at the hands of heaven. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Hatsori eino ela srof hanotef mi'atzei haktof. What Rabbi Shimon does here, I think there might be, in Rashi you'll see another name, you'll see Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. He is coming to explain some of the items mentioned before. So he tells us that tsori, which was mentioned at the first line of this source, is a sap. It's sap that drips forth, hanotek, drips me'atze haktof, from the ktof tree, ktof, a type of tree. Boris karshina, the role of this substance, boris karshina, sheshofin bo es hatziporen kedei shitei no'o. It was rubbed on, the boris kashina was rubbed on the tziporen to make it look more pleasant, because the tziporen in its natural form was black. So the rubbing of this would make it look nicer. Yein kafrisin, sheshorin bo es hatziporen. The yein kafrisin substance was used for soaking the tziporen, kedei shitei azo. That would increase the potency, of the strength of the fragrance. Valo me raglayim yofin law. In truth, urine would be beneficial for this purpose. Elo she'en machnisin me raglayim lemikdash. But urine is not something that is brought into the Azorah, into the Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, if one were to think, let us say, of using me raglayim for increasing the potency of the ktoras, he would have to bring it out outside the Beis HaMikdash. And, well, that you can see from here is not an option. And that point that we just made, the point we just made supports Rabbi Yossi's teaching, regarding the ktoras, it's described as something holy. And from this we learn, kol maaseh lo yu elo b'kodesh. All of its preparation must take place in a holy area. And therefore, in order to benefit, let's say, from the Me'raglayim, one would have had to
take it outside of the Zohar, and that's not an option. And bringing, as the source itself says, bringing the Meiragam into the Azora is also something that is not an option. Therefore, the strengthening of the Tziporin through the use of Meiraglayim could not take place. Before going further, we have a topic heading that accompanies the upcoming Gemara. And it reads on the outside margin under our nosay, Dino Shurab Yosi Rabchanina, his law is Hachonas Ktoras Boi Lios Bakodesh, that the preparation of the Ktoras must take place inside the Beis HaMikdash. We have a Mivneh heading with a house form used here in an alternating direction and we call this a Ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of the give and take style of this upcoming Gemara. With the roof or the point facing up, they represent kushos al hanal. There are challenges, questions concerning Rabbi Yossi's law, namely that we see that it possibly the Torah could be prepared outside the Beis Hamikdash. And when the house form flips over with the roof facing down, that represents tshuvos, responses. So we continue now in the Gemara with a question, Meisvei. We present the following Tanaic source, Hamakdish Nechosav Ahayuba Dvorem Haruyim LeKorbanos Tzibor Yinosnu LeUmnin B'Shoran. The person sanctified his holdings, his property, and amongst his property holdings were items that were fit for public sacrifices, public offerings. They are to be given to the artisans, the Umnin, as their payment, as their wages. The details of this will be explained as we continue in the Gemara. Hani dvorim hurauyin mai ninu. What is this? What is being referred to of the things that are something fit for a public offering? E behemo v'chaya. If it's a reference to animals, and the intent is they're fit to be used as offerings, as sacrifices. Well, tana lei. Those are already taught in Maseches Shkolim. They're featured in Maseches Shkolim, and it's further explained that they wouldn't serve as an example because behemos are items that are useful for personal offerings as well. And this is something that Rashi points out in Dibur HaMaskel HaTana Lahu, where it says HaTana Lahu, they're Hasam B'Maseches Shkolim, they're mentioned in Maseches Shkolim, V'ani Ruyim Liyochid Kamolet Tzibur, they're fit for the private individual as well as the public. So this is not the intent of this particular source, which features things, items fit for public offerings, which gives the impression of something strictly for public offerings. So what is the intent of this comment? Continuing in the Gemara, I yenos shmona vesiltos, if it's a reference to wine, oil, and flour, tonale, those are also taught in Maseches Shkolim, and as we learned before in the Rashi, they too are something that a private person could bring as well. Elo lav tores, it must be a reference to incense. Incense is something that is brought only by the public, a national offering, and not brought by an individual. Now, what's the point? Here we have someone that's sanctifying his property, and in his property, we see that he has Ktoras. So, where was it prepared? It was prepared outside the Beis HaMikdash. So, the Ktoras being an example of something that's fit only as a public offering, and he has this in his possession, it must be that the Ktoras was prepared outside the Beis HaMikdash, and that is a question posed to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Hanina. Now, the house form flips over, you can see, this is a response, Omer Rav Hoshaya, but Oysa Hanitenes Le'umnin B'Shoran. This is a reference to the to Ktoras that was in fact prepared in the Beis HaMikdash, and it is given, it was Ktoras that we'll see later how this comes to be. Well, just for convenience sake, we'll refer to it as unused or leftover ketores that had been prepared in the Beis HaMikdash at the end of the Beis HaMikdash, we'll call it the fiscal year. They had leftover ketores that was given to the artisans as their wages. The snan, we apparently then have a person that was an artisan, that was a worker in the Beis HaMikdash, and he received ketores that had been prepared in the Beis HaMikdash as his wage. And that this source of hamakdish lechasov that we saw a couple lines up is referring to someone who dedicated his property to the Beis HaMikdash, and amongst his holdings was this ketores that he had received as a wage. Disnan moisar haktores maho yu oisin ba. Moisar haktores is the leftover ketores that we mentioned before. This is ketores that was prepared in the Beis HaMikdash, and it was prepared in, we'll call it, one large quantity, and they would draw from it on a daily basis. But by the end of the fiscal year, which was at the which the new year begins at the beginning of Nisan, there was at the end of Adar this Mosar Ktores was left over. This leftover Ktores, what did they do with it? Mayu Oisinbo hayu mafrishin schar ha'umnin. They would set aside money that would be used to pay the workers. This Mosar Ktores, which was given to the workers, was then, it's the sanctity that it had was then redeemed onto the money. That's Mechalin Osa, the Mosar Ktores al Mos Umnin. Venosnin Oison Umnin. This Mosar Ktores was then given to the workers once the sanctity had been removed and transferred onto the money that would have been used to pay the workers. So the money now absorbs the sanctity, and the Ktores becomes sanctity free. Then, after the workers received this sanctity-free ketores, newly collected funds were then used to purchase the ketores from the workers, and then would be recycled, so to speak, reused then in the Beis HaMikdash. But for our purposes, let's do a precision focusing right now. We're dealing with the ketores in the source above of Hamakdish Nechasov. We're dealing with ketores that was prepared in the Beis HaMikdash, that was given to the owner in this case. He was apparently a worker, and he sanctified his holdings apparently before the Beis HaMikdash purchased from him with the newly collected funds the ketores. Before they purchased it from him, he had sanctified his holdings. But for our purposes, not to lose sight of the forest for the trees, we just have to review the main point that the ketores so far is, like Rabbi Yossi Bechina says, prepared in the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara asks, Maskif lo Rav Yosef, Ha bekulu mosros tani, with regard to all other leftover items that were not used by the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishnayos say, they teach, Chozrin v'loikhin oisa mitruma chadasha. It is bought, it is, those leftovers, they are then given to the workers through the process we mentioned before about having the sanctity redeemed onto money, and then those items that were left over and not used by the Beis HaMikdash were then bought using newly collected funds which we call the Truma Chadasha, and bought back from the workers and then used in the continued Beis HaMikdash service. The Hocha Lo Toni, but in the case of the Mosar Ktores, or more accurately, in the case of Makdish Nechosov, that case of Makdish Nechosov, which you said was talking about the Ketores, but it doesn't say this expression of Chozrin V'loikhin Oysa Mitruma Chadasha. So, since it doesn't say that in the source, it's most likely that it's not talking about the prepared ketores. Because if you were talking about the prepared ketores, it would have said in that source of Makdish Nechasov this phrase of Chozrin Veloichin Oysa Mitruma Chadasha. But it doesn't say that. Elo Omar Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef explains in such an explanation, again, strengthening Rav Yosi Rav Chanina, and at the same time explaining the Makdish Nechasov source. So Rav Yosef says, Be'echod misamamone haktoras. Not prepared ketoras. The person described in the source that started off this volley of questions and answers, in the Meisvei source that you can see several lines above, the person who sanctified his holdings, and we said he had in his holdings things that were fit for a korban sibor, he had the raw materials, the ingredients needed for ketoras preparation. So that's what he had. But he didn't have prepared ketores, because prepared ketores must be prepared in the Beis HaMikdash, and as we said, it couldn't be talking about the case of the workers and his being paid with that, because the phrase of Chozrin Lochen Osa Mitruma Chadasha was missing. But it is talking about a ketores related topic, and namely the ingredients, the raw materials needed for the ketores. And just to review the main point once again, however, there is no challenge to Rabbi Yossi B'chanina's teaching that the actual preparation of the ketores must take place in the Beis HaMikdash. Tonu Rabbanan. Ketores Hoysonasis 368 mona. Shin Samaches is 368 mona. Mona, we said, was a measure of weight. There was 368 mona in the that number you could get to if you just add up all of the different weights mentioned earlier of the various ingredients. Shin Samache means 365 keneged yemois hachama. That means for every day of the solar year, which is 365 days, one mona of ketores would be used. Now there's a balance of three mona. Shloisha monim yiserin. There were three extra mona. Shemehen machnes kohen gadol melocha fonov b'yoyim hakipurim. On Yom Kippur, in addition to the daily ketores offering, there was a special inner sanctum ketores offering. The quantity for that was, in effect, the scooping up of two handfuls, where a person would cup his two, the Kohen Gadol in this case, would cup his two hands together and scoop up what's called moloi chafonov. That's the handfuls of incense on Yom Kippur, and that was offered in the inner sanctum in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He would scoop up this moloch hafonov from a bowl containing the three mona, that was the balance of the amount we just mentioned. Now the handful that he scooped up was not the full three mona. There was a balance. There would be left over after he scooped it up. Vashar nitenes leumnin bischoron. The whatever was left over would be given to the workers as their payment. And we mentioned the procedure before involving the redemption of it onto money, and then the redeemed ketores given to the workers, at which point it would be bought back from the workers with the newly collected finances after Aleph Nisan, the beginning of the new fiscal year. Let us point out that every year this amount was made, 368 mona. They would automatically make that. There was this extra amount that we just made reference to that was left over after the Kohen Gadol scooped up his double handful for the Yom Kippur service. That amount, whatever that balance was, it would accumulate, because you had the fixed 368 made every year, and every year there would be this little extra left over of that, the leftover of the three mona would be left over, and that would be that would eventually accumulate year after year, accounting for a certain significant amount in and of itself. So that in addition to the fixed 368 that were prepared every year, most of it used, but that balance would then accumulate. Kedisnan, as is featured now in the following source, Moisar HaKtoras Mayu Oisinba, this extra Ktoras that was left over after the Kohen Gadol scooped up his double handful from the three mona, what did they do with that extra? Mafrishin Schar Umnin, Unechalin Oiso, Al Mois Umnin, they would set aside the some money that would represent the wages for the workers. They would transfer the sanctity of the Ktoras onto those monies. The Noisen Oison Lumin Mishran, they would give the Mosar Ktoras to the workers. The Choizrin Veloichlin Oisa Mitrumas Halishka, they would then collect, they would then repurchase from the workers the Mosar Ktoras that they had received from using newly collected funds. Tonu Rabbanan, we're now at the very top of Omid Beis, where we continue in this topic of the Mosar Ktoras. On the outside margin, we have a nosei, a topic heading, where we've written Achas L'shishim or L'shivim Shana, once every 60 or 70 years, Lo hayu tzrichim lefateim elo chatzi kamus Ktoras. They wouldn't have to prepare more than half the original, the full amount of the Ktoras. In other words, if the full amount of the Ktoras was 368 mona, so half of that would be 182 mona. Why, after 60, 70 years, would they be able to get away with that, so to speak, or save so much? Because the accumulation of that balance of the three mona that from which the double handful of the Kohen Gadol was scooped up, that kept accumulating, as we said. Quantity-wise, it would accumulate because they were every year they were remaking the same 368 mona. So and then they had this balance that they kept buying back from the workers. It accumulated to the point that after, as we say here, 60, 70 years, and you'll ask why this range of time? Well, the amount in the balance all depended on the size of the Kohen Gadol's hands. And over 60, 70 years, you might have a change in Kohanim Gadolim. And they had different handfuls, counting then for a different amount of balance. So there was a certain amount of range here of time. And this source tells us about that, this idea that after 60, 70 years, they simply didn't need to prepare the full 368, but rather they would prepare half. Ma dino, we've continued in under our topic heading, ma dino shel yochid hamefateng pochos mikashiur shel ketores. What is the law as applies to a private person who, as we said, is not allowed to prepare the Ktoras? Let's say he doesn't prepare the official amount, but he prepares less than the official amount. Let us now continue with the Gemara at the top line. Tonu Rabbanan, Mosar HaKtoras, Achas L'shishim O L'shivim Shana. Regarding the Mosar Ktoras, we're told that after 60, 70, or 70 years, they would prepare the public Ktoras only half the amount. Because on a public level, half the amount would be prepared at times, as we mentioned, once every 60 or 70 years, that's what the public would do. The counterpart on a private level would be held guilty for preparing half the Ktoras as well. In other words, not only preparing for personal use the 368 mona, but 182 mona of Ktoras preparation would also generate this penalty. Let's read this again. Divrei Rav Shimon Amliel, Sheomar Mishum Hasgan. Rav Shimon Amliel himself was quoting the Sgan, assistant when he said that. This Skan often refers to the Skan Kohen Gadol. The Girsa of the Shita Mubetzis reads here, Shomar Reb Shimon Mishum Ben Hasgan, the son of the Skan. Aval Shlish Urevia Lo Shomati. However, the preparation of a third or a quarter of the total amount, that I don't know. The Chachamim Omrim B'chol Yoim Misakein B'maskunta V'hoyo Machnis. The Chachamim present a strict opinion which says that in theory they could have prepared even a sufficient amount for daily use and Machnis and brought that into the Heichal for being offered. Therefore, even one mona, which was the daily amount, could be processed by the public, and hence the counterpart on a private level would be held guilty. Rashi says the maskunta lishno dekra. The word maskunta is a Torah expression, but it means the quantity or the sum, the amount. Im hoya roitze lefate makteres devar yoim biyoimoy. If they wanted to prepare the Torahs on a daily basis, oisa, they could have done that as well. It's true, we mentioned before that they would prepare the 368 mona in one shot and draw from it over the course of the year, but this opinion is saying they could prepare it on a daily basis, which would be one mona per day. Hilkach yachid shalopitem ela mona chayav. Therefore, the private individual who would do that would be held guilty, and he would be chayav kores. Misayale l'rova. This supports Rava, the Omar Rava, Teres Shepitmo l'chatzoyin chayav. Rashi is quick to point out that the word l'chatzoyin that Rava uses is not specifically half, but any amount that's fit to be offered. So that Rava is saying a private person who prepares for personal use Teres of any amount would be held guilty. Dichtiv v'akteres asher ta'aseh. Kol shita'aseh. Any amount that you make, v'ha efshur de'ovda pras b'shachris u'pras b'enu arbayim. Pras is a half a mona. It's possible to prepare a half a mona in the morning and a half a mona in the evening for the late afternoon offering, and that would be used in the Beis HaMikdash, and hence a private person that would prepare those quantities would also be held guilty. Tonu Rabbanan. As the Gemara goes on, we have more information regarding the use of the Keteres and how it was dealt with by the Beis HaMikdash. So the source says, Keteres hoyu machzirin oisola machteshes pamayim bishona. We mentioned that they would make a lump sum, a 368 mona at one time. That was returned to the grinder, the machteshes, twice a year. The Rabbeinu Gershom says in order to renew the fragrance. B'moys hachamo, during the summer months when it was hot, it would be spread thin in the grinder, shalotis apesh, so that it shouldn't become moldy. B'moys hakshamim tzvura, during the cold winter months, it was piled up, Kidei shelo tofug recha, so that it shouldn't, the fragrance should not dissipate. Ukshu shochek, and when they were grinding, Omer, there would be a constant repetition of this phrase, hodek, hetev, hedek, hotev, which means grind it finely. Divrei Abba Yossi ben Yochanan. This is the teaching of Abba Yossi. Shvisholosh monim yiserin, the extra three mona shemehen kohen gadol machnis mulo chafon of biyom kippurim, from which the kohen gadol would scoop up his handsful for Yom Kippur. No sein oisol machteshes be'erav Yom Kippurim, that would be returned separately to the grinder on erev Yom Kippur. Vishochakon yofe yofe, they would be ground very finely, kadesh te dako min adako, so that it should be extremely finely ground. Kedesanya, daka, the pasuk in the context of Yom Kippur and the incense mentions daka. Ma Talmud Lomar? Why, in the context of Yom Kippur, do you have to say finally ground? Balok Far Nemar, but it already says in Sefer Shmos regarding the Torahs in general, V'shochakto Mimenu Hodek, that it shall be finally ground. Ma Talmud Lomar Daka? Why, in the context of Yom Kippur, does the word Daka appear again? Kidei Shetehei Daka Min Adaka. The extra Daka reference is an indication that the Yom Kippur incense must be extremely finely ground. Omar Mar, it was said earlier, Kishu Shochek, Omer, Heitev, Hodek, Hodek, Heitev, that when they're grinding, they should announce this announcement. These four words, and it would be repeated. Messiah Leila, Rabbi Yochanan, this supports Rabbi Yochanan, the Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Kishem Sha Dibor Ra Liayin, Kein Ha Dibor Yofe Lebesomim. Just like speech, possibly sound and noise, is negative, is injurious to wine. In other words, in wine cellars, one has to maintain silence in order for the wine to ferment properly. By the same token, speech or noise is actually beneficial for the preparation of the incense. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Yud Aleph Samimonim Nemru Loi LeMoshe B'Sinai. Moshe Rabbeinu was taught 11 ingredients when he was on Mount Sinai. In other words, there are 11 ingredients, even though when you look at the pasuk itself, you don't see 11 ingredients listed by name. Before going on in the Gemara, we have included the pasuk in the margin, Shmois Perek Lamed Pasuk Lamed Dalid. The pasuk says, "Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, kach lecha samim, nataf ushcheles vechelbono samim ulevoino zako bad bevad yiyeh." Now, from this pasuk, we are going to eventually learn that there were 11 ingredients. Omar Rav Huna, my craw, what's the pasuk that says there shall be 11 ingredients? The pasuk says, Kach lecha samim. The word samim are spices, and it's a word in the plural, therefore tray. It's a reference to two. Natav, shcheles, v'chelbana. Those are three items. Ha chamisha. That gives you now five. V'samim. The pasuk repeats the word samim after it listed those three ingredients. That word, v'samim, achrini, another samim word, indicates chamisha, another five. In other words, you, up till that point, you accounted for five, and then the word samim would replicate the five. Ha asora. That would account then for 10 ingredients. The pasuk also mentions afterwards ulevoy nazaka, which is chad, another individual spice. Ha chad sorry. Now you have a total of 11. The Gemara asks, who says that is the approach to the pasuk? The question we're about to learn, we have listed as a long question. You can see the kuf that's encircled that appears to the immediate left-hand side of the Gemara text with a descending vertical dashed line that takes you to the third of the widest lines, third of the wide lines. All of this is makes up the question. We should point out that at the first of the wide lines, there will be a bracketed section that lasts for three lines. Following the bracketed section, the Gemara will give the answer to the question, so that the basic question will end right before the brackets, and the use of the brackets is to enable us to skip to get right to the answer. We'll go over this structural note when we get there by use of our note that accompanies the bracketed section on the side of the Gemara. But in the meantime, we have a diamond. We have to explain its purpose. First of all, we have a nosei topic heading that we should have read maybe a few minutes ago, but it says, Mispar ha-samimonim ha-shonim b'k'toras. The topic deals with the number of different ingredients. We're not dealing with the total quantity, the weight that we dealt with earlier. Here we're dealing with the number of ingredients that were used. if I'm not mistaken, if one were to look back on Daf Vav Amud Aleph at the source that was at the began at the second wide line of the Gemara, Pitum HaKtores, there, in fact, was a list of all 11 ingredients. And there were other substances mentioned in that source, but as we mentioned at the time, those other substances were not part of the ingredients, but rather were service items, as the source had explained, as Reb Shimon had explained in the source itself. So, in the there you will see the 11 ingredients by name. As far as the pusuk is concerned, though, you don't see 11. You see, as we saw, the drasha here involving the word samim and the repeat of that word, eventually getting you to 11. We have a mivneh note that features the diamond. Under the mivneh note, we see the diamond on the outside margin, and we've written hatsos chilufios, alternatives. L'droshas Rav Huna, alternatives, alternative approaches to the pasuk, meaning an alternative to the way Rav Huna had mentioned this. Be'inyan mispar hasamim, regarding the number of individual ingredients. So here we start with the suggested alternative reading. V'ema, why not say as follows, samim klal, and we might as well say ahead of time, according to this alternative reading of the pasuk, we will the point will be not a teaching that the pasuk is not teaching me anything dealing with numbers, but rather characteristics of the ingredients. And therefore, the Amos say, why not say as follows? Samim equals klal. Samim is a general expression. Not of ushchelis v'cheldena equals prat. They are itemized. Individual points as opposed to a general. Samim, the word samim appears again, is chozar v'kolal. That would be a second general statement. And then this gives us a structure, a pasuk structure, klal uprat uklal. When you have a structure like that of general, specific, and then general, I atodon elo ke'ein haprat. You are to evaluate what else could be included based on the nature, the characteristics of the individual specified items. Maha prat mefurash, just like the prat, is the individual items have the following characteristic. Dover shekiter ve'oyle ve'reichoy noidev. It is something that when burnt, it burns in a pillar form, and it in other words, it smokes and the smoke rises. And reicho nodef, its fragrance scatters. Af kol dovar shekiter v'oyle v'reicho nodef. So too, any other spice that has that characteristic, that when you burn it, the smoke rises and the fragrance scatters, would be acceptable for the ktores. And according to this approach, the pasuk is not dealing with numbers, it's dealing with rather a description of what might be suitable for the ktores. That's the question. The question then, in other words, is where do you see numbers in this pasuk? Now, if we skip the brackets, im kein, the Gemara answers, mikach l'cho nafka lei. And Rashi explains, Rashi, you'll see, where the Tosfos ordinarily appears, as we mentioned already on a few occasions, that in Maseches Krisus, Rashi occupies for a number of dapim the two columns. So we refer to this as the outside column, the lower part. Rashi says, "Im kein the bechlal uprat uklal luchud boy lemidrashay." If the purpose of the pasuk was simply for a klal uprat structure, then lo nichtav cross samim, the pasuk didn't have to use the word samim at all. Ela kach lecha. Have a mashma klal. The kach l'cha expression, which appears in the pasuk, would have been enough. Kach l'cha also has this general ring to it, and yet the word samim does appear. Ela hochi nokat bereisho samim uksiv nami kach l'cha. Therefore, we learn from here that l'midrash klal uprat uklal. We are, yes, to darshan it in this klal uprat uklal fashion, namely describing the characteristics, l'koiter v'oyle kidele kamon, that it should have this characteristic of burning and the smoke rising. And secondly, ule minyan yud aleph, which is 11. And also for quantity or for number purposes, 11 ingredients. Now, in the bracketed section, you'll notice there's a note, a star that appears before the brackets. So to the outside margin of our Gemara, we have here Hesber HaSograyim. Sograyim Elu Haim L'Shem Vilug. The purpose of bracketing these three lines is for skipping purposes, as we just demonstrated. Kedei L'Hagia Miyad L'Tshuva, so as to enable us to get immediately to the answer. The question had been, according to the diamonded suggestion, the Pasuk is not reflecting anything to dealing with number of ingredients. How can Rav Huna say that it does? And then when we skip the bracket section, we got to the answer. It says, well, the Pasuk in fact covers both elements, the nature of the ingredients and the quantity, like Rav Huna. Betchilas haketa basograyim, at the beginning of this bracketed section, yesh nisayon lidchois hasheela, there is an attempt to reject the question, to show that the question is not to be asked, velomar, and to say, de'ima posuk bo l'shem klalu prat bilvad, if the purpose of the posuk is for the klalu prat structure, then hoya maspik l'chtov prat echad, it would have been enough for the posuk to mention one specified ingredient, and that, there you would get your, you'd have your klal prat uklal structure. You have the general, then the one ingredient, which is the specific, and then again a general. Why does the Pasuk not do that? So apparently it's not like the suggestion of Ema. Avol, ha-gemora miyad doiche ve-oimeres de-tsrifi l'chol prat. The Gemara itself, though, will say, no, no, the Pasuk really is a klalu prat fashion, and if you're bothered by the fact that you have so many specifics mentioned when one would have been enough, that's not true. One would not have been enough. Rather, I need each specific example. And as a result, the question will remain, Dulai Matras HaPosuk, maybe the purpose of the Posuk is Lidrash B'Klalu Prat. Avolo Nidrash Mimenu Minyonen, not to darshan from the Posuk, not to derive from the Posuk anything dealing with numbers, number of ingredients. So now we turn to the bracketed section and read. V'chi Temo, and if you were to say in Cain, if so, that the Pasuk is like your suggestion that it's only for klal uprat purposes, lichtov kro chad prata, then the Pasuk should have written just one example, one detail. And since it didn't do that, but listed three, so it's not for klal uprat purposes, lai means in truth. Mitzrach tzrichi. Each example is necessary. Each detail is necessary. Each specific example is necessary in order for me to eventually get to the description, the necessary description of the of what would serve as an ingredients for the ketores. The e kosav netef. Had the pasuk written just notof, have amino, I would have thought min ilon in avagidule karka lo. Only something that grows from a tree would be, just like the notof is, something that comes from a tree. But something that comes forth, that grows forth from the ground would not be acceptable. Mishum hochi kosav u'shcheles. Therefore, the Torah writes shcheles. The kosav u'shcheles. Had the Torah written just shcheles, havamina gedule karka in avomin ilon emolo. But shcheles being something that grows forth from the ground might be to the exclusion of something that grows or develops from a tree. Mishum hochi kosav notov. Therefore, it was imperative to write notov as well. You have notov and shcheles. The chelbena lugufei also. The presence of chelbena in the pasuk is for itself, namely, this is an item, strange as it may sound, is a foul-smelling substance. And therefore the pasuk, if it's to be included, something I never would have dreamed of on my own, therefore it's needed for itself to tell me that this chelbena, this foul-smelling substance, must be included. So at this point, we have revived the question, namely, that maybe the Pasuk is not coming to tell me a number of ingredients, and hence it's a challenge to Rav Huna's teaching. The Gemara answers, Im kein mikach lecho nafgot le. The Pasuk is, in fact, telling me
the nature of the ingredients, but it is also teaching me a number. Because if the pasuk was just for the klal uprat purpose, kach l'cho would have been enough to represent the first klal expression, and I would not have needed the word samim there at the early part of the pasuk. The fact is that the pasuk writes samim also, so from that I learn both points. I see to darshan and klal uprat uklal to discover the nature of the ingredients, and I also am able to darshan numbers of ingredients, like Rav Huna. The amor. Well, here we have a new suggestion about now. This suggestion will be a number-oriented suggestion. V'emos samim basroi train ninhu kisamim kadmoi. Why not say that the second appearance of the word samim is two, is a plural, and the minimum of plural is two, just like the first samim meant two. That was what we said originally. Rav Huna said that the first word samim meant two. Two spices. So why is it that the second samim doesn't mean the same thing? But according to Rav Huna, the second samim represented an additional five ingredients. The Gemara answers, Im kain, if the second samim simply means two, then nichtov samim samim bahadi hadodi, then the words samim should have been written one right after the other. They should have been written together. Ubosar hochi nichtov, and then following them write notov ushcheles v'chelbena. But it didn't write it that way. It split up the word samim, one at the beginning and one later on with the details between. Debei Rabbi Shmuel, Tani. We have a Tanaic source that comes from the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel that reflects the ideas that we have just learned, but it's presented in this Tanaic source fashion. And we also have a long marking to the immediate right-hand side of the Gemara. You'll notice we've written Bei Rabbi Shmuel with a descending vertical dashed line. That is here to show us that all of these upcoming lines of Gemara center around the Tana de Bei Rabbi Shmuel. In other words, we'll have his source. There will be a cryptic statement that appears at the end of the source, which will occupy the Gemara in trying to figure out what does that cryptic statement mean. And that will take us to the end of this long dashed vertical line. So we begin now with the source. Samim Klal. We saw this before, the reference to the word samim in the pasuk. He takes that to mean a general. Notav shcheles v'chelbena equals prat. Samim equals chozer v'kolal. And this is very familiar, I'm sure, to all of you, because we just got finished this in our first diamond that we had just a few lines above. Here it appears in this source. Showing you, by the way, that the suggestion that the Gemara made as a Gemara suggestion really had a foundation in a Tanaic source. So that having been said, the Brisa goes on, Klal uprat uklal, iatodon elokein haprat. When you have a structure of a pasuk like this with a general, specific, followed by a general, we say as follows. We say, iatodon elokein haprat, you can judge as far as additional ingredients, things based on the characteristics of the details in the pasuk. Ma haprat mefurosh, just like the details in the pasuk, the examples in the pasuk are characterized by dovar shikita v'oyla v'reichai noidev, something when burnt, the smoke rises and its fragrance spreads. Af kol dovar shikita v'oyla v'reichai noidev, so to any other substance that has those characteristics. Oy eino ella, or maybe, and now there follows a line of this source that's cryptic. O eino ella klal b'klal rishon uprat b'prat rishon. Amris, the answer to that cryptic question is lav ha ein l'cho lecho lodun b'loshon achroin ella b'loshon rishon. Answer says, do not assume that suggestion of the O'eno Ella. In other words, this don't follow whatever that was intended in this cryptic remark, but rather go according to the first presentation. And now the Gemara analyzes. Omar Mar, this is a quote of what we just saw. O'eno Ella, klal b'klal rishon uprat b'prat rishon. Amris lav ha ein olecha lodun. That's a quote. My kushya. What was the question when the source said o ein o ela klal? What was bothering this source? Hochi kokashyolei. Thusly was the question in the source. Kihechi dekashyolon, just like we had asked earlier. In other words, why not say samim basroi trei ki samim kadmoi train? This was a this appeared above in our second diamond, a few lines up. So the ema that we had asked, coming off the heels of Rav Huna's teaching, in fact, is what is bothering this source, in the source itself. Maybe the drosha of the word samim is a number-based drosha, and that the second samim word is to be learned like the first samim word, meaning two. Hodar vishani kidishanin. Then the Brisa answers like we answered, the imke nichtav kro, if that were the case, then the Pasuk should have written samim, samim, notav ushcheles v'chelbino. If the role of samim was, let us say, not for the klalu prat form, but rather for number form, for a number fashion, and to tell me two and two, plus the additional three, then it should have been set up, the Pasuk should have read like this, samim, samim, notav ushcheles v'chelbino. But it doesn't read it like that. Umay prat b'prat rishon. What is the meaning of that expression that we saw in the source? We had seen in the source we called the cryptic line which said eino elo klal b'klal rishon, which we explained what was bothering the source, meaning the problem with the word samim, and now the expression prat b'prat rishon, what is bothering the Tana here? Hachi kokashyo lei. Thusly, he is questioning. Maybe, mine ilonos yalfi min notof, other kinds of tree growths will be learned from notof, gidule karka yalfi mishcheles, and other ground growths will be learned from shcheles, velilfi nami milavona zaka. And let us learn from Lavona Zaka, the Afilu Bechad Tzad, that even if a new ingredient has one of the characteristics, the Nesi Dover Sherecho Nodev Afopisha Ein Koter Viole, that I would learn from Lavona Zaka something that has a pleasant spreading fragrance, even if when burning it, the smoke doesn't rise. Maybe that's what Lavona Zaka comes to teach me. Unlike that which was taught in the source that you need to have two characteristics of spreading fragrance plus rising smoke. Maybe one of those two characteristics would be enough. Hodar Omar. And we have a little one over here in anticipation of a number two coming up later, and we'll see the purpose soon. Hodar Omar Imkein, if that was the purpose of the pasuk, Imkein Nichtav Kro Levona Zaka Bemitzi. Levona Zaka should have appeared in the middle of the pasuk, but if you look at the pasuk, the Levona Zaka came after the second Samim word. It came toward the end of the pasuk. Once again, if the role of Lavona Zaka was to perform a type of role like the other details did, serving as a precedent for other things, and you want Lavona Zaka to serve as a precedent for this, something that has a pleasant fragrance, though the smoke doesn't rise, then it should have been written together with the other ingredients which are precedent setters.
Let's read that line again with the from the number one. Hader Omar, then he answered, Im kei nichtav krolu levona zaka b'mitzi v'neilif mino, and then learn from it, having been written in the middle together with the other examples. So the Gemara says that, well, it couldn't have said that, I kasve levona zaka b'mitzi, if it had written levona zaka also in the middle, then havion tre asar, I would have come out with 12 ingredients, namely the first samim word representing two. Then I'd have four examples. 2 + 4 = 6. And then the second samim word would have represented a doubling of that amount, another 6, giving me 12 ingredients. And I know there are only 11. Well, im kain, Niftov kro levona zako bimitzi v'chelbina libesof. We could have solved that problem, namely, if levona was really there for teaching me to include something that has only one of the two characteristics, we could have kept levona zaka, or we could have placed it in the middle and taken the chelbina and put that at the end after the word samim, thereby giving me 11. But it didn't do that. The pasuk took the levona zaka and it kept it out of the middle, showing that levona zaka is not here to teach me characteristics of other items. So according to what we've learned just now, the ingredients must have two characteristics. Any additional ingredients that you bring into the Keteris must be Reicho Nodef plus Koter Viola. How do I know that? And how do I know that it must also be Koter Viola and not Reicho Nodef alone? Well, that is learned basically from the fact that the Levona Zaka is not included in the list of details as in the middle of the pasuk with the other ingredients, but kept till after, later in the pasuk. Reish Lakish Omar, Reish Lakish addresses this very point, and he says, Migufa, from the word itself of the topic, Ma Loshon Ktores, what does Ktores indicate? Dover shekoter viole, something that burns in a rising fashion, so that the word itself is a giveaway and would be a response to the suggestion that maybe I don't need that characteristic. Comes along the pasuk itself, the word ktores, telling me I must have that characteristic as well, that it's koter viole in addition to reicho nodef. So what we've just done in the last 5-6 lines of Gemara is explained what the cryptic statement in the Tana Beis Shmuel source represented when it said, O'eno ela klal b'chlal rishon, uprat b'prat rishon. The source was attempting to raise these two questions, namely a question regarding the use of the word samim, and a question regarding the necessary characteristics for additional ingredients. Omar of Chana bar Bizna, Omar of Shimon Chasida, Kol Tainis She'ein Bo Mipoishi Yisrael, any fast day. And in the Mishnayos and Gemara, we find numerous references to the need for fasting. Fasting was a means of prayer and a seeking of atonement. So that any fast that's declared, and she'ein bo mipoishi Yisrael, and the sinners of Israel aren't participants in that, eino tainis, it won't accomplish what a fast day is supposed to accomplish. This is a very beautiful idea, a beautiful idea of unanimity, of togetherness, of what we call in Hebrew achdus. Where does Rav Chana get this idea that a tainus, a day of supplication, of prayer and fasting, of atonement, must, in order to achieve its goal, must have in it the sinners of Israel as well? Sharei chelbeno rechora. We have as the basis of this teaching the ktores.
One of the ingredients was the chelbana, and it had a foul odor to it. Umona kosuv im samamone k'taras, and yet it was an integral part of the k'taras. And in fact, we saw earlier that if you're missing any of the ingredients, including this foul-smelling ingredient, the one who would offer such a missing k'taras would be guilty of misa, would be punishable by death at the hands of heaven. So even though you have this foul-smelling substance, it must be present in the k'taras. So too, with regard to the Jewish people seeking atonement through prayer and fasting, the sinners of Israel must participate as well in order for it to be effective. And along those lines, one cannot say, well, they're sinners, you know, what are they worth anyway? And the sinner also cannot rationalize and say, well, I'm full of sins, how could the Almighty possibly accept or value my prayers and supplication to begin with? All that is a false attitude. It is the counsel of the evil inclination, but not so. The Almighty is concerned with each and every Jew, and is waiting and anticipatory of each and every Jew's prayer and supplication. And there's a special value, even for a sinner, to turn to the Almighty, and the realization that the Almighty is the source of salvation is itself something to be valued and cherished, even in the event that a person is a sinner and full of sins. There, we can almost say there are two separate issues here. There's a person turning to the Almighty, realizing that He is the source of salvation, and that reality could very well be where a person knows that he, let us say, is weak and yields to his temptations and his evil inclinations, and at the same time that does not contradict his recognition of the Almighty as being the source, the only source of salvation. We often parallel in analyzing and looking at these topics in Judaism. We look at a father-son or a child-parent relationship where the child may not follow the rules of the house and obey his parents, but when he needs something, that child will come running to mom or dad, give me this, give me that. So that doesn't contradict the fact that the child is disobedient, doesn't contradict the bond between parent and child and the child's recognition of the parent being the source of salvation. It may be that on human terms, a parent will not respond because of the disobedience, but when it comes to the Almighty, there is no question that the Almighty cherishes the very fact that a person turns to Him and realizes that He is the source of salvation, even though he may be full of sins. We're certainly not encouraging this type of lifestyle or behavior, but we are showing, and this Gemara points out very clearly how significant this relationship is. And not only the Chelbana serves to demonstrate this, but you have here Reish Lakish, as we have a little number two over here, and he says, just to correct that little mistake here, we have a little bays over here, Abaye Omar Mehocha. Abaye says, from here, from a different source, we see this same idea. The Pasuk says in the prophet Amos, Perek Tes Pasuk Vav, Va'agudasoi al Eretz Yisada. And Rashi says, Va'agudaso, the word aguda is a bond, bound together. Mashma shekulon biyachad. When everyone is together, Oz al Eretz Yisada, then there is established on the ground, meaning something has a foundation, has a basis, when everyone is together. The Gemara continues, V'hasoch b'shem el ha-mishkan. Another one of the Kores penalties is for one who smears the special anointing oil. Tanu Rabbanan, hasoch b'shem el ha-mishkan, lebehemo v'kelim poter.
one who uses the Shemen HaMishkal, the special anointing oil, and smears it on an animal or on vessels, is exempt. Or if he smears it on heathens or on the dead, he is exempt. Bishlamah Behemov Akelim, I understand that is exempt. Dichtiv al basar adam lo yisach. The pasuk warns against the use of the special anointing oil for smearing on adam, a person. Ubehemov akelim lav adam hu. Behemoths, animals, and vessels are not characterized as adam. Mesim nami, the fourth example as well. Potter is exempt. To give the mislay, once a person dies, mes mikri v'lav adam. It's called that's referred to as a corpse, not a person. When you're dealing with idol worshippers, why should there be an exemption? Ha adam ninu, are they not adam? Are they not people? Lai, in truth, idol worshippers are not called by the term adam. Dichtiv, the pasuk says ve'aten sonitzon marisi adam atem. That is a pasuk, and here there is a limitation. Atem kriyim adam. You, the Jewish people, are called adam. Ve'ein ha'odik v'chavim kriyim adam. And idol worshippers are not called by the term adam. They can be called anashim, be called something else, but the word adam doesn't apply to idol worshippers. And when you go back two lines to the dashed underlined adam word in the pasuk, it said avasar adam lo yisach. Don't smear the anointing oil on the flesh of adam. And only the Jewish people are referred to by that term. The Gemara asks, well, how can you say that idol worshippers are not included? V'hoksiv v'nefesh adam shisha asar aleph. That pasuk is a reference to idol worshippers, and it says there that the nefesh adam, there were 16,000 nefesh adam. So the Gemara answers, Amalei hahu lafuki behema. The use of the word adam there, it is true that it is a reference to idol worshippers, but it is only because in the same context animals were referred to. So in contrast with behema, the word adam is used to refer to idol worshippers. But if you were dealing with a statement not in the context of animals, and you were referring to idol worshippers, you would not use the word adam. The Gemara asks from another pasuk, v'hoksiv v'ani lo. This is a pasuk from the book of Yonah. In the book of Yonah, there is the story of the Kodesh Baruch Hu and his mercy and compassion for the city of Nineveh. Nineveh was a city of idol worshippers. And it says in that pasuk, Vani lo achus al Nineveh, Mishneim also ribo adam. The pasuk mentions the Kodesh Baruch Hu's desire to have compassion for Nineveh that contained in it more than Shneim Osar Ribo, that's 120,000 Adam. So you see the word Adam used in the context of idol worshippers. The Gemara answers, Ahu Nami Lafuke Behemo. That pasuk as well was referring to the population of Nineveh of people in addition or besides Behemo, besides animals. So that once again, you have the word Adam as referring to idol worshippers, but only in the context and in contrast to Behema. But in isolation, the word Adam would not be used to refer to idol worshippers. And as a result, when we look at the pasuk dealing with the Shemen HaMishcha, Al-Basar Adam Lo Yisach, that was the word Adam in isolation, not together with Behema. V'boyes Ema, another approach, Kidakotoni Tano Kamei Durbalazar, as is taught by the Tana, who's taught a source in the presence of Reb Elazar, Kol Sheyeshno Besach Yeshno Bebal Yisach, V'chol Sheeno Besach Eino Bebal Yisach. In order to appreciate this, we glance at the Rashi. Kol Sheyeshno Besach, Kol Shehu Over, Keshu Sach Es Atzmoi, Oy Achirim. Anyone who would be in violation when he smears either himself or he actively smears others, shemetzuva shelo yosuch mishemana mishcha lazar. Anyone who is commanded not to smear others with the anointing oil, yeshno bebal yisach mitzuvim achirim olov shelo losuchu. So others are commanded not to anoint him. However, idol worshippers that are not commanded with regard to this prohibition of not to smear others. It's not one of the mitzvos that are given to the world population. Therefore, they are not ones concerning whom, if they would be the subject of the smearing, there would be no violation. So once again, only with regard to those people who are commanded actively, not to actively smear others, so smearing those kind of people would carry with it guilt. However, people that are not commanded to restrict themselves from smearing others, they themselves, if they were to be smeared, would not carry with it guilt. Therefore, if a Jew smears an idol worshipper, it would be potter, would be exempt. Tanyo idoch. Hasoch b'shemen ha-mishcha, one who uses the shemen ha-mishcha to smear lebeim of kelim levdikachovim umesim potter. This is similar to that which we've learned already. Lemelachim ulekoyhanim, one who uses the shemen ha-mishcha to smear or to appoint to anoint kings or high priests kohen gedolim after they were already nimshach. Rameir says, well, you know, you're using it for no real reason. They've already been anointed. So therefore, if you were to use Shemana Mishcha on a Kohen Gadol or a Melech after he was already anointed, the one who pours it on them would be guilty. Rebuta Poter. Rebuta says, one is exempt. V'kamo Yosuch V'yechayov. How much anointing would a quantity of oil would carry with it guilt? Rabbi Meir Omer Kol Shehu, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Kezayis. Rabbi Meir says any infinitesimally small amount would carry with it guilt. Rabbi Yehuda says no, a minimum of Kezayis, of an olive quantity, only that amount would carry with it guilt. Less than that, no. The Gemara asks regarding this line that we just read in the source. How is it that Rabbi Yehuda is speaking about a kezayis as being chayev when earlier on that line Rabbi Yehuda said there would be exemption? The Amar Rabbi Yehuda potur. Did Rabbi Yehuda not say that there is exemption? So the Gemara answers, ki potur Rabbi Yehuda gabi melochim v'kohanim. Rabbi Yehuda mentioned potur, but only in the context of using the Shemana Mishcha on a king or kohen gadol that had already been anointed. Gabi Hedyot Mechayev. However, regarding the use of Shemen Amishcha for a commoner, that would carry with it guilt, according to Rabbi Yehuda as well. And then, in that context, the source is asking how much oil would generate the guilt. So to that, Rabbi Yehuda answers a kezayis quantity, an olive quantity. Omar Mar, Rabbi Meir Omer Kolshu, Rabbi Yehuda Omer kezayis. We saw this just now, this Tanaic controversy regarding the amounts of oil that would generate guilt. B'mai pligi, what is the basis of this controversy? Omar Rabbi Yosef, b'ha pligi. The following is the basis of their controversy. Rabbi Meir Sovar, al basar odom lo yisach ksiv. The Pasuk says that you shall not smear the oil on the flesh of odom, on the flesh of man. The uksiv vasher yitain mimenu al zar. And the Pasuk also mentions the yitain giving to it on a zar, on a non-fit individual. Ma sicha kol shehu, af nesina kol shehu. Just like smearing is any amount, so too the giving of it is of any amount. The Rashi explains ma sicha kolshu delo ashkechon shiur besicha. We don't find any quantities associated with the smearing. Af nesina kolshu af al gav de nesina ba'alma kezayis. Even though nesina in general is characterized as a kezayis quantity, but since here in the context of the Shemana Mishcha, we see it paralleled with with sicha, I understand that the quantity of putting on others is a kol shehu. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, Yalfinon Nesino de Alzar, Mi Nesino de Almo. Rabbi Yehuda says, I learn the idea of Nesino Alzar, of the placing on a non-worthy individual, from the giving that you find in other contexts. Ma Nesino de Almo Kezayis, just like in general, where you find a pasuk, Rashi quotes a pasuk, V'nosan L'Koyenes HaKodesh, which is a pasuk found in the context of eating, and we know that eating is almost always characterized by an aleph quantity. So just like nesino in general is kezayis, af nesino d'alzar, so too the placing of the oil on an unworthy individual is kezayis, an aleph quantity. Avol sicha lemimshach melochem v'koyhanim divrei kol kol shehu. However, when it comes to the amount needed to anoint kings and high priests and kohanim gedolim, everyone agrees that a kol shehu, there is no fixed amount, even a very small amount is sufficient. The Omar Rav Yosef, B'mai Pligi Rabbi Meir Rabbi Yehuda Gabi Melochim v'kohanim, what is the basis of the machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir regarding kings and kohanim that were already anointed? We saw that above, where Rabbi Meir said that anointing a melech or kohen that was already anointed carries with it guilt, and Rabbi Yehuda says it's exempt. Rabbi Meir savar vasher yitain mimenu alzar ksiv. The pasuk warns against the placing of the oil on a zar. And umelech v'koyin hashta zorim ninu. The koyin and melech, after they've already been anointed, are considered unworthy. Zar meaning literally a stranger or foreigner. So they are foreign to oil once they have already been anointed. Rabbi Yehuda savar. Rabbi Yehuda says, bo'inon ad di'iko zar mitchiloso v'ad soifoi. Zar in the pasuk is a reference to someone that from the beginning to the end is a zar, is unfit or unworthy of the oil. Umelech v'koyim karo lav zorim havu. But a king and a kohen gadol, from the beginning, they weren't zorim, they were worthy to have the oil anointed to them. Omer of Iko, Breder of Ami, the azdu l'tamayu. You'll see that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir are consistent in their analysis with that which they have taught elsewhere. Disnan, we now turn to the top of Daf Zayin. We have a Tanaic source that deals with a Bas Kohen, the daughter of a Kohen. A Kohen, as everyone probably knows, is entitled to a Truma tithe. This is a percentage or a fraction of a person's harvest that he gives to a Kohen. A Kohen eats this, and a non-Kohen is forbidden to eat it. And if a non-Kohen eats it, it carries with it a heavy penalty of Misa Bidei Shamayim. The Kohen and his family are entitled to eat it, including his daughters. The halacha is, though, that a Bas Kohen who marries a non-Kohen, who marries out of the Kahuna, is no longer entitled to partake of Truma as long as she's married outside the Kahuna, or she has children from a man who is not a Kohen. There is a penalty for the consumption of Truma. We mentioned that if one does it knowingly, so he's chayav Misa, and there is also a financial obligation that he has to compensate. He has to pay the principal plus a fifth. Another point that we ought to know before we learn this source is that a Bas Kohen, if she is married and engages in immorality, adultery, she is punished by the Sreifa method of execution. A standard, a non-Bas Kohen, a standard Jewish woman who practices adultery, is punishable by chenek, by strangulation. Sreifa being a exposure to molten lead, heat, which is called, it's translated literally as burning, but it has to do with that
particular method of execution that's associated with the molten lead. That sreifa penalty is characteristic of a bas kohen. But now we continue with the source. Bas kohen sheniseis liyisrael viochla betruma, a bas kohen who married a non kohen, a yisrael, and ate truma when she's not allowed to. Mishalemes is a karen ve'eno mishalemes is a choymish. She pays the principal of the principal value of that which she ate, but no additional fifth. Umisasa b'sreifa, in the event that she is guilty of immorality, she will be punishable by the bas kohen special execution. Niseis le'echad min apsulin, if she marries a person who is unfit to be to marry, someone who's posel, someone who is unfit for her to marry, mishalemes karen v'chomesh, she then loses her bas kohen status insofar as she will now, if she eats truma, now being married to a posel, she'll pay the principal plus a fifth, umisasa bechenek, and she will be subject to the in the event of adultery, the subject to the common chenek method of execution, divrei Rebbe Meir. This is Shitas Rebbe Meir, who is here. Rebbe Meir is consistent with what he said before, that even though she started off as a bas kohen, she can lose that status by marrying a posel. But right now she's not considered, she loses that status, she's considered a zora. The Chachamim Omrim, and the Chachamim usually means the sages, here it's a reference to Shitas Rebbe Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda will say, Achazu v'achazu, whether she's married to Israel or even married to a posel, Mishalemes hakeren v'eino Mishalemes hachoymesh, she pays only the principal if she eats the truma, and her method of execution will be besreifa. What is the basis of Rabbi Yehuda? Because when the Torah refers to a zar having to pay a keren v'chomesh, the non-kohen, it would only be a case of someone who was a non-kohen from the beginning to the end. Here, she started off as a bas kohen, and therefore she is not treated with the zar standard. And we see here too, Rabbi Yehuda is consistent with what he said before regarding the need to have a particular status from beginning to end. And if not, so then they are not considered like that other category. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.